School board races, the perils of I-95, and a program for art lovers to become collectors. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. There's a presidential race and congressional seats up for grabs on this year's ballot, but also a lot of important local races. WLRN's education reporter Jessica Bakeman will introduce you to the school board candidates. Also, if you've lived in South Florida for any amount of time, you've likely had to get on I-95. It's a highway that requires a lot of defensive driving skills. A new Sun Sentinel report looks at why our piece of a highway that stretches all the way to Maine is the most dangerous. Finally,
we're able to collect as a group and as a community and make affordable together what we may not be able to do alone.
How to become an art collector even if you don't have millions. We'll talk about a program supporting local artists. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Well, there is a lot to consider on the November ballot besides who's going to be the next president. School board members have a direct role in your child's education, and this pandemic has illustrated their power in determining when kids were allowed to return to the classroom. Today, we're going to look at some of the candidates on the November ballot. In Miami-Dade, three school board seats are up for grabs. In Broward County, there's just one runoff, a countywide seat. Here to break these down for us is WLRN's education reporter, Jessica Bakeman. Jessica, great to have you back.
Thanks, Lewis.
All right, so let's start in Miami-Dade. Three seats up again. One of the hottest, most contentious races, District 9, the school board seat that includes South Miami-Dade County, that's Homestead, Pinecrest, Cutler Bay. Who are the candidates?
Sure. So there are two candidates in the runoff. One is Dennis C. Moss. That name might be familiar to some of our listeners because he has been on the Miami-Dade County Commission since 1993. In 2012, they put in term limits there. So he's coming to the end of two terms after those term limits were imposed, terming out and running for the school board instead. And he's facing Luisa Santos, who is an entrepreneur. She owns Lulu's Nitrogen Ice Cream, which is an ice cream shop in Edgewater. Both of them haven't necessarily been formally involved in education up to this point, but have some aspects of their experience that are related to education. So Dennis Moss has run a nonprofit center to help kids who've gotten into trouble. And it was something, it's basically an alternative education center. And it was something that he was inspired to do after seeing that there was a disproportionate effect of suspensions and expulsions on children of color, particularly Black children. He is Black. He's an immigrant from the Bahamas. And Luisa Santos is also an immigrant. She's came here from Colombia when she was a kid, found out when she was in high school that she was undocumented, eventually became a citizen, of course, since she's running for office. But that part of her personal story has definitely been, you know, part of what inspired her to get involved with kids and education.
The Miami Herald reported last month that the Democratic Party chose to endorse Luisa Santos over Moss. And this goes back to a controversial vote Moss took back in 2017 while on the commission. What happened there?
Yeah, so basically the commission was considering a proposal to end so-called sanctuary policies at county jails. So basically the decision meant that the county agreed from that point on to detain undocumented immigrants for ICE, federal immigration enforcement agents. And this is something that Democrats were against. They wanted to see those sanctuary policies stay in place. And Moss was one of three Democrats who voted against that. And he basically said in recently explaining that vote that he felt as if immigrants' rights groups, which are largely Latino in Miami, were not doing enough to help the Black community. And he also pointed to some other things he's done on immigration to be, an advocate for immigrants. And like I mentioned, he himself is an immigrant. But he doubled down on that during our interview, the idea that, you know, they criticized him saying that he was being transactional, and he said that he should be transactional in this case.
We've got cuts from both of them on this. Let's hear from Moss first.
And it needs to be more transactional, Because at the end of the day, the expectation is that black elected officials are supposed to support these issues. And when it comes down to issues involving the black community, you don't see the same kind of support and return. That's just fairness.
I don't view anybody's rights or plight or struggle as transactional. Human rights are not transactional. Immigrant rights are not transactional. Black rights are not transactional. And they should never be pinned against one another.
So, Jessica, this race has gotten very contentious. It's actually ended up in court. There's a lawsuit trying to get Santos thrown off the ballot. Briefly, tell us why.
So a lawsuit claims that basically she doesn't live in her district. She calls it frivolous and is fighting it in court.
All right, let's move on to, I want to move over to another race, this one from District 5. This one is Susie Castillo, a school board member on District 5. It includes Doral and Miami Springs. Both of the candidates for this seat have been elected officials before. Tell us a little bit about them.
Yes. So Mara Zapata was a vice mayor of Miami Springs. She resigned from that position to run for this school board seat. She's also a lifelong educator. She was a teacher and administrator in public schools and taught education at Miami-Dade College and now teaches at Florida International University. And then you have Christy Fraga, who is currently vice mayor of Doral. She is term limited and therefore running for the school board seat. She's also an entrepreneur who owns an ice cream shop with two locations in Doral and Kendall. I think it's really interesting that two school board races in Miami-Dade include a woman entrepreneur who runs a nitrogen ice cream shop. And Christy Fraga also has a five-year-old son who is in pre-kindergarten now, but will be in public schools in Miami-Dade. And she argues that's an important perspective of a parent of a small child to be on the school board.
Yeah. You know, there's another, I mean, that's an interesting twist. Another interesting twist, too, is that in this election cycle, you've got, you know, one of these races is pitting two teachers from the same school together, right? It's from the candidates from District 3, and I believe they both teach at Miami Beach Senior High School. Okay, so what's this race about?
Yes, so in this race, you have Lucia Baez-Geller and Russ Rywell. Both are teachers at Beach High, and both have taken a leave of absence this year for their campaigns. Baez-Geller is a 15-year teacher. She's been a union steward with the United Teachers of Dade and has been an advocate for public education in Tallahassee and in Washington, D.C. She teaches language arts and sociology. And then you have Russ Rywell, who teaches math, economics, and speech and debate. And his experience is a little bit more varied. He has experience in the finance sector, working for Citigroup in Singapore, and then later became a teacher and has split his two decades of teaching between Ransom Everglades, which is a private school in Coconut Grove, and Beach High, which is his alma mater.
Yeah. You know, one of the interesting things about this is, again, as we mentioned in the intro, is three seats will change. And so that could mean a big change in the shift in, you know, how the school board operates. But, you know, tell me a little bit about what that could mean with that kind of change. And how did we see the power of the school board members, you know, in this decision to reopen? I mean, that also kind of gives us a little view of what they really do.
Yeah, so three seats is a third of the school board. And I think there's been a lot of eyes and ears on the school board right now because of the controversial decisions they've had to make recently regarding reopening schools during this pandemic. Also, you know, there's always tension between a school board and a superintendent, and that's been on display between Superintendent Alberto Carvalho and the school board because of the issues that have come up with, you know, the cyber attacks and the software glitches that led to a really difficult start of this school year. So I think it'll be interesting to see when we get these new school board members on board, what their posture is towards Superintendent Carvalho. Are they going to sort of trust him to steer the ship and make decisions and be kind of hands off? Or because of some of these mistakes in recent months, are they going to be more aggressive about trying to get involved in, you know, what Superintendent Carvalho and his administration is doing in terms of, you know, leading the district?
Again, we're talking with WLRN's education reporter Jessica Bakeman. We're talking about the key races for the school board in Miami-Dade. Again, three seats are going to change. Let's move over to Broward County. And by the way, if you want to learn more about them, about the seats, Go to our website, WLRN.org. Okay, Broward County, Jessica, there's one seat up for grabs, at-large seat. That means it's countywide. Let's start with Debbie Hickson. Now, she lost her husband, Chris, in the Marjory Stoneman Douglas shooting in 2018. Ensuring school safety is one of her top priorities, and that's about more than just preventing violence in schools, especially now during the pandemic. Let's hear from her.
When I first started running, safety was a bad word, right? Because those of us that were impacted by the shooting have this sense of urgency, and other people felt like it was overthought. But now safety has a different connotation to it, and it means different things. You know, do we have the right PPE? Are we making sure we're social distancing?
So, Jessica, tell me a little bit more about her.
Yeah, so she is a 32-year veteran teacher. As you mentioned, her husband was Chris Hickson, who was killed during the Stoneman Douglas shooting. So she's been a very outspoken advocate for school safety measures since the shooting. She's also the mother of a special needs son. Her son, Corey, is 25, but developmentally his age is 8. And he has been doing an adult education program virtually during the pandemic. So one thing we talked about is how she really has insight into what that experience has been like for parents of students with special needs who've been really struggling with the virtual education experience during the pandemic.
And her opponent is going to be Jeff Holness. He lives in Coral Springs. He has two sons who attend schools near Stoneman Douglas. He points out that if he were elected, he would be the only father on the board. Let's hear from him.
I have firsthand knowledge and experience in both of those safety issues because I have a learning center where I'm transitioning kids to e-learning, and I'm also making plans to bring them back safely. I have kids in Parkland schools. So these are really pressing issues that we have. And the number one priority right now is how do we bring our kids back home safely to their parents and grandparents?
All right. So again, Jessica, tell me a little bit more about him.
Sure. So as you heard, you know, from both of the candidates, they're really focused on school safety, and they see that broadly as, you know, including issues related to the pandemic. He mentions here that he runs a learning center and is currently working through the process of bringing the students who come to his learning center back for in-person classes. So he feels like that experience could be useful as the school board is doing the same thing in Broward. And you mentioned that he would be the only father. That's partly because he would be the only man on the school board. The school board is currently all women in Broward County. There's also only one Black member on the school board currently. He is Black, and he's from Jamaica. He's been endorsed by the Democratic Black Caucus in Broward County, and he's a former teacher as well.
I do want to, as we move from the, again, these races, just in the last couple of minutes, I wanted to ask you, again, because we're in this pandemic, schools have reopened. You know, you've been following the stories of the reopenings in Broward and Miami-Dade counties. I just wanted to get a sense, how are they tracking cases of COVID right now and what's going on?
So both school boards, both school districts have dashboards on their websites that are showing, you know, whether there are new cases among students or employees and which school sites those are at. The Miami-Dade dashboard currently shows 11 students and one employee who have tested positive for COVID-19 since schools opened last week. The Broward dashboard is a little bit harder to make sense of because they've been putting up cases since before schools opened, but the Sun Sentinel reported there have been a handful of cases since schools started their reopening process on Friday. They're still going through that. They had more students back today, and more will be back on Thursday. And both districts are going through a contact tracing process where they're contacting parents and teachers in areas or in schools that have been affected by COVID-19 cases and, you know, doing sanitization procedures to try to make sure that those school buildings are still safe for the students who are continuing to go back.
And by the way, your reporting was part of NPR's Up First podcast this morning. It was looking at the drop of student enrollment in public schools. What can you tell us about what's happening in, like, for example, Miami-Dade public schools?
Yeah, so if you look at just the traditional public schools, not the charter schools, Miami-Dade has lost more than 16,000 students from last school year to now, and in Broward, it's more than 9,000 students. A lot of those students are leaving to go to private schools or to go to virtual school or to be homeschooled, you know, which is decisions that a lot of families are having to make about how to handle this situation. Obviously, it's really difficult. A lot of people have to work. They may be able to work from home, and they may just feel like virtual education isn't working so well for their kids. So, you know, we're seeing them have to make those difficult decisions and pull their kids out of public schools.
We have been talking with WLRN's education reporter Jessica Bakeman, and you can learn more about the races again in Miami-Dade School Board, Broward School Board, all of her work on the website WLRN.org. Jessica, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Lewis.
Well, still to come, the stretch of I-95 in Florida is the most dangerous part of the 2,000-mile highway. Why? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. If you've lived in South Florida for even a short time, you've likely had to get on to 95. So you know how harrowing an experience it is. Speeders, constant crashes, lots of fatalities. Would it surprise you to know that on the highway that stretches all the way to Maine, the most dangerous parts are here in South Florida? The Sun Sentinel recently investigated data between 2014 and 2018 and found 530 people died in fatal crashes on I-95 in the Sunshine State. Joining us now is Megan O'Matz and Brittany Wallman, reporters for the Sun Sentinel behind this investigation. Megan, Brittany, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And by the way, we want to hear from you. What is your experience on I-95? How often do you have to get on it? Can we make it safer, do you think? Is it possible? Give us a call, 800-743-9576. I want to hear your stories, your harrowing stories on I-95. That's 800-743-9576. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter. Post your story there at WLRN Sundial. Megan, there have been problems with speeding and traffic accidents on I-95 for decades. I mean, I've been living here since the mid-80s, so I've seen a lot. I've heard a lot. What have you seen, though, in recent years that raised the level of concern about the roadway?
Well, frankly, I like to live very close to where I work. And for many years, our newsroom was in downtown Fort Lauderdale, which was near my home. I had a 6-minute commute, which was perfect. Then a few years ago, our newsroom moved to Deerfield off of 95. And frankly, more of us in the newsroom were traveling 95 day in and day out. We're fighting that traffic just like your listeners. We're seeing these harrowing wrecks. The drivers creep up and swerve around us madly. I once saw a car moving with its passenger door, rear passenger door open. So it became, we have more conversations in the office, frankly, about these stories that we're all seeing on 95. And one thing kept coming up in our discussions was that, gee, we rarely see any police, and why is that? So we kept, you know, an eye out. When were we seeing troopers? And, you know, then when we started looking into the statistics, we found that the number of cars registered in Florida has increased by more than 3 million in the last decade, but the number of highway patrol officers that are devoted to general enforcement has dropped. And there are actually fewer troopers now than there were in the year 2000 when you take away the commercial vehicle enforcement folks. So
that, you know what? That was something. Reading your story, I didn't even think about it. Now, I try to avoid the highway as much as possible. Luckily, I could stay down here in Miami. But is that you pointed that out? There are fewer troopers. And then I thought about that the last time I was on there. I said, wait a minute. This road has expanded. In all the years I've been here, that highway has expanded so many lanes, but I don't see that many troopers. I mean, was that the thing that sparked this idea?
Yes, exactly. Because again, we were all traveling it, and we, you know, I think an editor was one of the first to say, you know, I rarely see a trooper. And when we started looking for them, we didn't see them either. And there's a reason for that, because there aren't enough of them. They're very short staffed. They have considerable turnover. Low pay. So the folks that become troopers, they leave within a few years to join other police agencies that pay more.
Yeah. And I want to get into that too, about the highway patrol. Brittany, you spoke to a number of different families who lost loved ones to accidents on that freeway. Tell us about Annette Bennett's story.
Well, she had two daughters, one age 2 and one age 5, and she was out of town, and the godmother was driving the girls to church. And she is just an example of one of those people that, you know, I mean, she didn't have them in car seats, mind you, but she said another driver swerved into her lane. She was forced into a wall. There was a crash, and both girls died. And, you know, there are so many stories of someone who is a good driver who gets a flat tire or is just minding their own business and gets hit. I myself, I'm a pretty decent driver. You know how often when you're on 95, everybody comes to a stop in front of you. I mean, it's just inevitable. And that happened, and the person behind me, I just watched in the rearview mirror as they just, I don't know if they were on their cell phone, smashed right into me.
Wow. Oh, my goodness.
So it's sad. There are so many people whose lives are ruined by things that happen on I-95.
Like I said, all the years I've lived here, from Palm Beach County all the way down here to Miami, the things I've seen and the stories that I've heard. Again, the number is 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Give us a call. We'd love to hear your I-95 story, you know, whatever it may be. And yeah, some of them are, they're so strange that you have to laugh. And some of them are just so horrible, so depressing. And I know there's even memes about this. And I think there's an Instagram post where people post videos of some of the dumbest things people do on that highway. Let me go to the phones. I want to go to Ross in Pompano Beach. Ross, thanks for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Hi, yes.
Tell me what's...
Take you on speaker.
Oh, okay. What's your experience? What's your story?
Well, I'm a transplanted Canadian down here, and I drive I-95 regularly. And I am just appalled at the complete free-for-all that highway is, with no traffic. For all intents and purposes, there is no traffic enforcement at all on that highway. There's accident investigations. You'll see a blue light come on when somebody's...
Ross, I think, are you still there? Okay. I think we may have lost Ross. I apologize about that. But that's an interesting perspective. He's from Canada. I've heard from people who are from out of town or from somewhere else. They can't believe what they see on I-95. Also, by the way, I've driven in major cities. I've driven through New York City, driven through Dallas. Houston is not pretty. And Los Angeles. I probably would rather drive in those cities than on I-95 here in South Florida. One of the key problems on the roadway, obviously, is speeding. Some of you will remember former WLRN journalist Kenny Malone. He spent a year reporting on I-95 for the series The End of the Road. And I wanted to play this piece from February of 2015. Brittany and Megan, hang tight. I want to go to this story because I think this really helps us kind of get a picture of what 95 is like.
It's the thick of afternoon rush hour. I'm standing just south of the Adrian Arsh Performing Arts Center and an on-ramp to I-95. There's a line of traffic inchworming its way onto the highway.
Hey, man, can I ask you a question about 95? Do you know the speed limit on I-95?
I think it's 45.
55?
Yeah, 65.
75 miles an hour.
That last voice is Olivia Riva. She's in a silver Audi sitting in on-ramp traffic.
Am I right?
You're pretty far off.
Really? What is it?
Maybe the better question is, why don't we know what it is? Distraction, willful ignorance, maybe. The speed limits vary, but they are posted if you're looking for them, starting
right here at the 45 mile per hour speed limit sign at the end of the road or beginning of the road, depending on which way you're looking at it. And then it raises to 55 miles per hour here, just south of downtown Miami. And then it turns to 60 miles per hour right here, 4 miles away, just a little bit north of the 112.
It's then more than 23 miles before the speed limit hits 65 in Broward County. Knowing the speed limit is one thing, of course. Following it is another. On parts of I-95, during certain times of the day, the average speed of traffic is 5 to 10 miles per hour over the speed limit. Perhaps no one knows this better than the following I-95 commuter.
Yes, I'm attorney Stefan Lustig.
Lustig runs the Ticket Titan law firm, the one whose logo is an ancient, muscle-bound warrior impaling a traffic ticket.
You know, it's funny. It's all anecdotal, but we often see this crazy driver, and where the hell's the cop when you need him, right? And that's generally what people see, but they're also not seeing when officers are pulling people over.
A lack of enforcement on I-95 is the most common complaint we've heard during our End of the Road series. like from Kristen Taylor, who moved here 2 years ago and commutes daily on I-95.
I've even started asking my friends that live in Miami, you know, does anyone get speeding tickets here?
But Taylor admits she's also part of the problem. She speeds.
Yeah, I go 80. Just to keep up, or I feel like people are going to plow me down.
Taylor's originally from the Dallas area and feels 100% like her commute has turned her into a worse driver. And her complaint about the enforcement, it's like a cry for help.
In Texas, I drive well because there are a lot of police officers and there are repercussions. So, I mean, going back to my what I do for a living, I'm a teacher. If you don't have rules in the classroom, the kids are going to just go haywire in the classroom. So I think that applies to people on the road too, right?
Traffic citation data aren't broken out by specific roads, but in 2012, the most recent year that's available, there was a 6% drop in speeding tickets written in South Florida by the Florida Highway Patrol. Trooper Joe Sanchez promises his Miami-Dade colleagues are out there.
They write tickets, but this is what we've done, and I want to show you.
Sanchez pulls out a 5-page document.
We have a major operation called Operation 95 Saturation.
Sanchez says his office has been getting so many complaints about unchecked speeding and reckless driving on 95, they had to respond. Troopers will flood I-95 in Miami-Dade. More officers, more visibility, more traffic citations. For now, it's just a 5-day trial starting in early February, which leaves time for adjustment for people like Olivia Riva. Back on the 95 ramp, I filled her in on the actual posted speed limits.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought it was 75.
You just go as fast as you can, don't you?
Well, I usually push over 80 because I want to get places, but...
Just then the light changes. As Riva pulls away, her license plate comes into view, Quebec. No word yet from the FHP as to whether or not mile-to-kilometer conversion confusion will be a viable excuse during Operation 95 Saturation. I'm Kenny Malone in Miami.
And again, former journalist Kenny Malone, that was from his series back in 2015, The End of the Road. You can find more of that on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Again, I'm talking with, two Sun Sentinel reporters who put together an investigation and looked at the part of I-95. Again, the almost 2,000-mile highway. The part of I-95 that's most dangerous is here in Florida. Megan O'Matz and Brittany Wallman are joining us now. We also heard from you on our social media. Kayvon Antonio Haidari on Twitter posted this, wants to know about the accidents and deaths in South Florida after the special toll lanes were set up. Did the Sentinel look into this? Megan or Brittany, do you have an answer to that?
Well, we did not look at the statistics, but we did talk with the officials about that, because in Miami-Dade, people might have noticed that in order to make room for those toll lanes, they had to make the regular lanes a little narrower, which is, kind of scary driving. But they claimed that this is safer and moves more traffic. I think that's something that we should revisit once they finish adding the toll lanes all throughout Broward and Palm.
Yeah. Megan, the number of tickets, one of the things you point out in your story is the number of tickets went down, the number of accidents went up. Do we have a sense why law enforcement is not doing more patrolling?
Well, just like your caller, Ross, had said that he notices that the troopers, he sees them responding to accidents. And that is what they have told us as well, that so much of their time is spent responding to accidents that they don't have as much time to devote to proactive enforcement, catching those speeders and those aggressive drivers that switch from lane to lane and drive really fast. So, and they also have other duties. They have to go to court and they have to do training and they get time off as well. So really they've told us that the percent of the time that they have that they can devote to general enforcement is not that much.
And I think, as you had also pointed out in the investigation, Florida spends a lot less on Florida Highway Patrol than other states are spending on their highway patrol. Why is that?
Well, we're cheap. we're a low tax state, and that is not been a priority over many years. The troopers have been at one point they were the lowest paid among all the states. They have gotten some small raises in recent years, but they're still at the bottom of the heap, and that's why the turnover is so great.
All right. I want to go back to the phones. And again, you can also find us on social media if you can't get through, again, on Twitter or Facebook at WLRN Sundial. Let me start with Mary in Pompano Beach. Mary, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks. I just have a comment. I had similar situations as the reporter had stated about being rear-ended on 95, October of 17, I was rear-ended on my way to work. I live in Pompano, commuting to Delray. Wasn't very bad, but shaken up, got my car fixed. 3 months later, was seriously rear-ended on 95 again because of that, what they call the natural accordion flow, which I didn't know. I hurt my back. I now have spinal stenosis, herniated discs. But the other thing that's kind of related to this that just absolutely shocked me is that the person that, and I think the same thing, I think that they were on their phone because I don't know how they could not have slowed down.
Yeah.
I keep a lot of distance between myself and the person in front of me. I barely touched the person in front of me. I got rear-ended and was pushed into the car in front of me.
Yeah.
But in any case, what really shocked me was the person that hit me did not have insurance. So I had to actually sue my own insurance for my medical bill.
Wow.
But so how is that allowed that people are driving a Mercedes, no less, without proper insurance?
No, well, we see a little bit of everything here. Mary, are you okay, though, right now? Are you doing all right?
Yes, I'm fine, but it's affected me so much that I actually have recently lost a job, and I'm looking, and it's difficult, as we all know, to get a job right now. But I am limiting my job search to where I don't have to go on 95 because I'm you really literally put your life in your hands.
To get off the highways. I'm in a position. I'm very lucky. I don't have to do it. Mary, thank you so much, and I hope that things get better. Thank you for sharing that with us. Before I go back to the phones, again, we've been hearing from a lot of folks, on social media as well. Cosmic Miami on Twitter says, if you're involved in a crash on 95, to stay in your car if it's safe. There have been several pedestrians hit and killed on the highway. If someone is in an accident, what are some of the safest practices? That's actually a very good point as well to bring up. Thank you, Cosmic Miami. You know what, Megan, coming back to you, the other thing is this. I mean, you said it, Florida's cheap. We're not spending money on highway patrol, not enough compared to other states. What are lawmakers saying? And have any lawmakers spoken to you after the investigation?
Well, not yet. We're still reaching out to them, but one of the main issues is the jurisdiction, I believe, of the Highway Patrol. And I mean, their name is the Florida Highway Patrol, but yet in certain counties, they are on rural roads, they're on county roads, there, because some sheriffs refuse to handle any traffic investigations. So the FHP is responding to fender benders in residential parking lots and bike versus golf cart accidents. And we need those troopers to be on the highway. And certainly if you're going to look at the jurisdiction of the Highway Patrol, one task force many years ago recommended that they evaluate it based on county and the number of wrecks on a road. And by all means, certainly 95 would be right up there with the roads that deserve considerable attention.
Yeah. All right. I want to go to a story here. Denise in Miami Beach, you have a story you want to share. I know it's a powerful one, but if you could please be brief for us, but please go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, Denise. I can hear you.
Okay, yeah, this is some time ago. My son is grown now, but when he was 7 months old, I was on I-95. Fort Lauderdale was an accident. Traffic was stuck miles on both sides, and I looked in the back seat after a while, 2 hours, just sitting there, and all of a sudden, I looked at my son's eyes are rolling back in his head. He's foaming at the mouth. He's going into heat stroke because my air conditioner cut off, and I jump out of the car. I'm in the middle of I-95 on one side, screaming at the top of my lungs with my son in my arms, and a doctor in a BMW and a nurse in a Camry. They snatched the baby from me, brought him in the doctor's car, revived him, and had to keep him in there. Everybody forgot about me. I almost passed out.
Oh my
Someone
God.
Grabbed me. And finally, what they had to do is a rescue truck had to try to squeeze along the wall to get to us. And thank God my son survived. And the man gave me the plate for my car. He said, don't ever bring this car on I-95 again. And they took me in the ambulance. I left the car there. My son survived, no brain damage. But they need trees. It was a horrible experience, and I would never want anybody else to go through that.
Oh, my God.
Thank you.
Denise, awesome. Thank you for sharing that, and I'm glad that your son is fine. And I'm just picturing this as you're describing it. I mean, you're in the middle of the road. I've seen this before, though. I've seen people, they can't get off to the sides, so they're just stuck in the middle, which, of course, you're 6-7 lanes. All of a sudden, that's just chaos. Brittany, the other thing that jumped out, I'm going to come back to the Highway Patrol for a second, is that, one, how much they make, which probably stands to reason why they can't keep people, because the average Highway Patrol person, officer, is in the job for just a few years.
That's right. It's almost like the FHP is a training academy for local police and sheriff's offices. And it makes no sense that they wouldn't resolve that, except for it, you know, would be expensive. But a trooper makes about $42,000 a year. If they're down here in these expensive counties like Broward, they make an extra $5,000. But compare that with, let's say you were working at Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office. Well, you're going to be making $56,500 as a new deputy. So it's just, you know, and to maybe have a more interesting and exciting job rather than just traversing a scary highway and running from wreck to wreck.
Yeah. And you know, listen, I think I understood, as you pointed out in your investigation, that the Highway Patrol don't want to put their lives at risk. You pull somebody over, what are you going to do? You're at risk. Let me go back to the phones. We'll get one more call in here. Robert in Palm Beach. Robert, thanks so much for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for taking my call. I'll make two quick points, if that's okay. One is that, so maybe you were alluding to this, that when cars are pulled over in really heavy rush hour traffic, it can actually cause other accidents to happen, rear-ending especially.
Yeah.
The other point is that I often see, not often, but I see radar set up. I see a cop sitting on the side of the road with radar. And yes, they might catch speeders, but I call them the highway sit. They're not patrolling. If they get on the road and they're driving on the road at the speed limit, it's going to be much more effective in keeping the cars around them
than to be stopped.
Limit.
That's an interesting point. Yeah. Robert, real quickly, what's your other point?
Oh, those were the two.
Okay, great.
That pulling someone over could cause an accident.
Yeah.
And that if they're the highway sit as opposed to the highway patrol, they're catching speeders, but they're not having a more beneficial effect slowing down the traffic.
Robert, thank you for the call. Two interesting points. Let me finish up here. Megan, Brittany, I mean, where does this investigation go now? And, you know, you're not hearing from any lawmakers. We have a session coming up next year.
Well, it's an election.
Go ahead, Britt.
Yeah, Brittany, go ahead.
I was just going to say, one of the difficulties with this politically is that who wants to be the poster child legislator who caused you to get a citation on 95? And so it's really hard to get these legislators behind the idea of amping up enforcement so that people are going to be ticketed.
Yeah, that's actually a very interesting point. Megan, anything else you want to add on this, on the investigation?
Well, I would just say that, yes, we are still reaching out to lawmakers and we hope that they will respond. I mean, everybody, you know, the governors are busy, you know, with elections and campaigning and all, but we're reaching out and we hope to hear from more because it's such an important issue for everyone, as you can see by all the response you've gotten today.
It was a lot of calls that we couldn't get to. Brittany Wallman and Megan O'Matz, again, of the Sun Sentinel. Check out their latest investigation on the dangers of I-95. It's on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And again, you can always let us know your story, your thoughts on trying to make that road safer, if it's even possible. Brittany, Megan, thank you so much for the time and the insight.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. Still to come, you don't have to be a millionaire to support the local art scene. We're going to talk to you about the program Commissioner, now in season 3. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Art shows and concerts as we know them may be a thing of the past. The way we buy and enjoy art is changing because of the pandemic. There's a local program connecting aspiring art collectors to local artists and their unique work, and it's back for season 3. It's called Commissioner. One thing that has stayed the same is how it continues to provide a steady income for artists who have been affected by the pandemic. Last week, we spoke with the co-founder of Commissioner, Deesha Carrington, about the future of arts patronage. You know, it's been a couple of years since we first talked about the Commissioner program. Remind people how it works again.
Commissioner is an art membership program that's designed to help novice and beginner collectors build their collection. A member can join at the collector level and they'll receive 4 pieces of newly commissioned work by Miami artists. And that might range from a sculpture to a painting or to a photograph. I mean, the idea here is that we're able to collect as a group and as a community and make affordable together what we may not be able to do alone. In addition to the artwork, we offer virtual and socially distant events right now. And programming helps folks learn more about collecting and learn more about the artists and their stories.
Let's talk about one of the artists. This is from season 2, Johan Rahman.
My work is focused on the Black community. In spite of poverty, in spite of proximity to crime, there's so much joy, there's abundance. But those things are not often portrayed in the media. And so I use my practice to look at those areas of Blackness and to make them as magnified as possible.
Tell us a little bit about Johan.
Johan is a photographer from Trinidad, and she's also based in Miami. She started an important project called Black Florida, where she essentially traveled the entire state taking photographs of people in Black communities and repatriated those photographs to those folks and to their families. She's helping people learn more about photography, learn more about documenting their own stories, and is creating a living and breathing archive of Black Florida.
One of the things I remember about the program the first time I talked to you was I thought, the really cool thing is that artists can grow a relationship with the buyer. A lot of times the buyer is just buying art and then that's it. They have it. But this gives them an opportunity sort of to build a relationship. Has that happened?
Absolutely. I mean, that's exactly the point. It's one of the many reasons why we always want to do an artwork reveal. So we want collectors and our members to get to know the artist first and then get to know the object or the art second. It really is all about relationships and context and knowing that our group of collectors is going to be there for the artist even beyond Commissioner is the kind of ripple effect that we're hoping to achieve. I think that's when we'll start really knowing that our job is done.
All right, so we're in a pandemic, so that has impacted everybody's life. How has it impacted artists, though? Because you can't have shows, at least not, we haven't had shows in a while. But I don't know, how's the pandemic impacting artists?
Well, I mean, artists are people first. So I would say that it's not because they're alone or in quarantine per se that they may also be feeling creative. They may have not had access to their studios, and artists have different kinds of creative practices. I mean, a visual artist who has had access to a studio and their fabricators may be able to continue creating. But when we think about what's happened in the world of performance or video, these disciplines have been so greatly impacted. According to the Miami-Dade County Department of Public Affairs, I think COVID's financial impact on the creative economy was up to $99.5 million. And that was just as of the end of July. And I think that's why we really need to start talking about the power of the village. We can't just rely on institutions or foundations or even the government to support artists. It's time for us and for our neighbors, if we're able, to consider thinking about how we are supporting our creative economy.
What have you heard, from the art environment? What have you heard about how they are trying to deal with the limitations of a pandemic, but, you know, again, dealing with that the financial aspect of it?
I mean, I'm seeing a lot happening online, but I'm also seeing a lot more collaboration. Many artists are fundraising for social justice organizations and I'm also seeing artists supporting other artists too, to be honest. I mean, there's definitely a willingness to communicate digitally, and we can see that on social media for the most part. And I think there's a greater acknowledgement of how we are all connected that requires artists and even organizations to reconsider how we're sharing resources and definitely to think differently about funding sources.
I'm speaking with Deja Carrington, co-founder of the program Commissioner. Season 3 is now open for you to sign up as a collector or as a patron. You can find more information on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Is there any particular artist who's like who has a story that you could share that really kind of paints that picture for us?
Well, one artist that I'm thinking about in particular is Jessie Schilling. As a photographer, she created a print sale called Sunny Projects with photographers around South Florida, raising money for social justice organizations while lifting all of the participants, all of the artists along the way.
One other artist I wanted to look at was Giovanna Gonzalez. She is from season 3.
You know, one of my most recent pieces titled Playlet A, which was a sort of modular piece that's based off of a tete-a-tete design. And essentially what I was trying to communicate and continue communicating with that piece is this idea of analyzing, critiquing what it means to share space, public space specifically, as queer women of color.
Tell me a little bit about Giovanna, please.
Giovanna Gonzalez is our inaugural artist for season 3, and we could not be more excited to have her. And that's not only because she has an incredible artistic practice in her own right, but also because of her curatorial practice called Supplement Projects. I think she's really going to bring the heart for building community and the eye for her design and for her art to the program. And that's what I'm excited about. What folks are going to see is the intersection of the two. And that is an important part of feeling welcome and feeling a sense of belonging.
So both Art Basel and Miami Art Week have moved to virtual. They'll be very different than the arts fairs attracting thousands of buyers and collectors from the past. When you spoke with artists, what did you hear from them? How is it going to affect them?
I think a lot of artists are excited about the possibilities of just moving forward. I mean, art happens here in Miami year-round and not only during Basel. This isn't to say that big collectors still can't see the work online or that galleries aren't going to be putting up significant exhibitions. I think it's quite the contrary. Primary, David Castillo, Nina Johnson, and Namdi Gallery are among our favorites here in Miami and are still going to be presenting their top-notch shows. I mean, I think the benefit here is us locals will actually be able to go see the work in person and probably in a physically distanced way, as we should, but hopefully we can get more involved and invested in what's happening in our city. This is definitely a moment to be creative, but it's a moment for us to spotlight what we have happening in Miami and take advantage of our global network as well.
Not having physical events, in-person events, how important is that? I think about musicians and like so much of what they make is in concerts, not album sales. But with artists, not being able to have people walk around and see the work up close, I mean, how does that affect them?
I think artists and people in general need that human connection. And so it's affecting them like it's affecting all of us. But also because we're in this situation together, I hope we can realize that we need to adapt. And I see a lot of folks showing up for each other, even if it is online. So while our preferred way of viewing might not be through a screen, I think a lot of younger people, especially the digital generation who are used to interacting online, aren't afraid to take the leap. I mean, we're also seeing a lot of early stage and emerging artists share their work in the virtual space. And in many ways, they've probably been able to expand their audiences. I'm sure some artists are even having deeper communication now that they're behind the screen rather than at the center of a busy gallery opening, for example.
I wanted to get a sense of art supporters, art buyers right now. What's their attitude? What's their mentality? Are they still feeling philanthropic? The economy is struggling and we're in an election year, but I don't know. What do you see on that side?
Don't think that buying is actually slowing down from an online sales perspective. You know, when it comes to the global art market, because millennials are the fastest, largest growing market, in the past 4 months, there have been more online sales of artworks than there has been in the past 4 years. So that tells you something about how hungry and how encouraged people are to continue collecting artwork.
Let me finish with this, because this is something I like to ask a lot of people. You know, we don't know how long this pandemic will last. We don't know really when we get to go back to anything resembling normal, what we remember. But we know that things will change. A lot of industries are going to have to change and adapt and may never go back to being the same. So that's not a bad thing necessarily. But what do you think is going to happen with the art world, our art sales? Do you think that we have to get back to what it used to be like? Or do you think the world is going in a different direction anyway?
You know, there is no going back. The arts in general will forever feel the impact of this economic crisis. But I do think we have it in us to be creative, adaptive, and to use technology to work with each other and to build something anew. I don't know what the future holds, but it's going to have to be something wildly different. And to be honest, I'm not completely opposed to that. I mean, the truth is that COVID exacerbated a lot of pre-existing issues. We need an overhaul, and if you will, it needs to be more inclusivity-driven, and it also needs to be more community-driven. More people need to feel welcome and involved, and I think there's a real opportunity not only to get more folks to the table, but to reimagine what that table looks like altogether. So I would say that I'm cautious, but I am also optimistic.
Again, that is Commissioner Co-Founder Deesha Carrington, and you can learn more about how to become a collector or a patron. Again, it's Commissioner Season 3. Find out on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Well, that's our program for this Tuesday, October 13th. Coming up tomorrow on the show, President Trump was in Florida yesterday for a rally. Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden is in South Florida today. We're going to look at their outreach to the black vote. Also, in the midst of the pandemic, the U.S. is at risk of facing a nursing shortage. We're going to hear from the head of FIU's nursing school about how they're trying to recruit more nurses. And finally, Miami-Dade County Commission set to vote on a radically new program for busing. Will it get more people in public transit? All of that coming up tomorrow on the show. As always, stay safe, be good to each other. I'm Luis Hernandez. We'll talk to you live tomorrow.